A Podshape production.
It was a sunny Saturday in Adelaide on the 25th of August 1973. It was getting close to footy finals time, and Les and Kathy Ratcliffe and their young son David and daughter Joanne were excited to watch their beloved Norwood on the Redlegs play.
The Rover will put it forward from centre wing towards centre half forward. Hobby in the front spot. Couldn't pull it down. Knocked on intelligently by Sorrell. Full mark for that one over the Grimwood. He's slow, the little Rover, but gets his boot in towards the goal just in time to squeak.
On the other side of town, four-year-old Kirsty Gordon was not as excited about a football game, but she was excited about being with her nan for the day, who was a Norwood fan and was planning to take her granddaughter to her fortnightly ritual at Adelaide Oval. The day started like any other, but by the time the sun went down, two families' lives were changed forever.
Well, of all the baffling crimes that have been committed in this city, few are more heartbreaking than the disappearance of Kirsty Gordon and Joanne Ratcliffe.
We're particularly looking for information concerning the happenings at the Adelaide Oval during the last quarter of the game.
This is Little Lost Girls. Episode 3, Bear, the Unlikely Hero. So far we've heard that Joanne Ratcliffe and Kirsty Gordon went missing, or were more likely abducted, from the Adelaide Oval on August 25, 1973. The family have spent years searching for answers, and although there were some sightings of the girls both leaving the Oval and around the area of the Oval on the day, police have never arrested or charged anyone with their abduction. No bodies have ever been found, and what happened to these two innocent girls has remained a mystery for over 47 years. We've shared with you the detail of one suspect, a pedophile, who was charged with the murder of two children in Queensland, but was never convicted and escaped any punishment because the courts deemed him unfit to stand trial because of dementia. Arthur Brown, by the records, died an innocent man, although most people believed he was far from innocent. Head back to the first few episodes to hear the story unfold. Right now, let's return to Susie's recount of the police actions soon after her sister Joanne and young friend Kirsty disappeared.
There was a reward offered for your sister and for Kirsty. It started out at $200,000.
Yep. Well, it actually started out just after the girls disappeared. It started out at $5,000. That's what the government put up. Back in the 70s, $5,000 was a lot of money, I suppose. Mm. The public didn't think that was enough. There was a heap of guys. They donated part of their wage to the reward. There was also workers from Tip Top Bakery, where my dad worked. They donated part of their wage, and Tip Top Bakery itself donated $1,000. So it ended up being a total of $10,000 around that time, which, as I said, in the 70s, it was quite a lot of money. Over the years, the reward was increased to $200,000 for information leading to the location of the girls or to the apprehension and conviction of the abductor. In 2013, I read on a Facebook post that there was a $500,000 reward offered for information into the murder of a known drug dealer in South Australia. And it got me quite upset because I felt that they valued a drug dealer as being more important than, you know, the life of our two girls. And then also sort of looked across at some of the other rewards being offered and thought, well, $100,000 for the Beaumont children. That's pocket change to some people. I spoke with the detective inspector in South Australia and basically pushed for an increase in the reward. You know, I hoped even if it was just going to be like, you know, $500,000 equal to that of what they were issuing for the information for the drug dealer. after the detective inspector and the victims of crime officer from South Australia come over and spoke with me at my home in Wangaratta. We had quite a lengthy, quite volatile conversation on my part. They agreed that, yes, something needed to be done. There needed to be more publicity around not just the girls' cases, but to all cases, for them to realise that it's not just another file, it's just not just another case number that they bring up on their computer or pull out of the cardboard box on the odd occasion. There needs to be more dedication to the girls' case. There needs to be more investigations. There needs to be more publicity. And there certainly needs to be a large reward. In February 2014, they invited me over to South Australia to announce an increase in the reward. They didn't tell me exactly what was going on until that night before the announcement. And so it was a hell of a shock to me when they told me that the reward was going to be increased to $1 million, not just for Joanne and Kirsty, but for the Beaumont children, Michaela Cadell, Marilyn Qualman, Juan Morgan. In total, it was 18 kids under the age of 18, for 13 cases basically.
Wow.
We're going to be increased to $1 million.
I would like to invite Susie Ratcliffe to say a little about what the offer of this set of rewards means to her family and other families like her. Susie, if you could come forward.
Thank you. Firstly, I'd like to thank everyone that's been involved in this. This is it's a major significant change for my family and for other families that have lost their children. If this helps the vital clue to bringing our girls home or, you know, other children, then that's all that matters. Living day by day, not knowing where our children are, it's incomprehensible. It's a pain no one should ever have to endure. My family have missed out on seeing my sister grow up, go to school, all the different highs and lows of her life, getting married and having children of her own. My parents had to lose a child that, you know, you never believe that you're going to lose a child. You always believe your children are going to bury you. And to lose a child to ill health, it's something that, you know, it's painful, but you can at least bury them and you can grieve for them properly. But not having a body to bury and to actually grieve for her properly.
Just take your time.
I'm sorry. This reward could mean the answers that my family and so many other families have been waiting for so long. And I just appeal to those out there that may have those answers, please find it within your heart to ring Crime Stoppers and put an end to our pain.
Thank you, Susan.
I'm guessing that once this $1 million was offered, this would have brought about a whole bunch of calls, as you said, 150 odd.
Yeah.
But equally, people coming out of the woodwork, like private investigators, starting to think, well, if there's $1 million on this, suddenly, if we can find the answer, there's a pretty large payday coming for us.
Mm-hmm.
Is that where the information from Robert Cameron, the private investigator, started?
No. Robert, or Bear, as he's affectionately known as, he started this investigation long before the rewards were even announced. Both him and a number of his colleagues had been investigating the girl's case for at least 4 or 5 years previous.
Robert Cameron, or Bear as he's known, is a former bikie who now owns a tattoo parlour in Adelaide. He's also a private investigator who came to learn about the Adelaide Oval abductions through a person known to him long before any rewards were offered and long before he met Susie or any members of the Ratcliffe family. Bear is, as you would expect, a heavily tattooed, larger man who has a beard, often wears a bucket hat and rides a Harley. He sounds scary, but as you hear Susie describe him and how he's helped the family, you can tell he really cares.
Oh, I didn't know this guy from a bar of soap, or any of the guys, for that matter. I'd never met them before. I'd never spoken to them before. And then, yeah, out of the blue, he was like a, you know, an angel on horseback. Just come in and, you know, he's made such an impact on our family. A few years ago now, I surprised him and I surprised Mum. Bear was living in Adelaide. He used to own a tattoo shop there. I took Mum around there. She had no idea where we were going. And it wasn't until we were walking through the door I told her what we were doing. And Bear come into the room, and I'd already met him on a previous occasion. So, he walked into the room and he looked at Mum and he started crying straight away. You know, this big, massive hulk of a man. He's like
pictures,
a bear.
I've seen videos.
Him and Mum just, they wrapped each other up in this massive hug. And I mean, it was, for anyone watching, that didn't know the story, they think it'd be quite funny because my mum at that stage was about 38 kilos. She was just this little toothpick of a woman. And you could barely see her because of Bear being so big. But they lingered in this massive hug for quite some time. You know, they were both crying. And Mum, when they finally broke apart, Mum said to Bear, she goes, "You have given me hope that I haven't felt in an incredibly long time." And to hear that, that broke me because, you know, it's been such a long time that Mum seriously thought that, you know, we may just be able to bring her home. Mm. And Bear and his team have been incredible.
When I spoke with Bear, he was at home in Adelaide with his dogs. You'll hear them in the background occasionally through our chat. We picked up after Bear tells me that he learned of a letter, a sort of confession that was given to one of his mates who knew a man called Mark Kevin Marshall, who was in jail for various crimes and was a known pedophile. Bear's mate met him in a cafe in Adelaide and handed him the confession from Mark Marshall.
At a little cafe, and which is a link to all of this as well. That's why he took me to that cafe. And he handed me a statement from a fella called Mark Trevor Marshall, and who was in prison for various pedophilia crimes, allegedly. I believe he is definitely a pedophile, but he was also a victim of this ring of pedophiles. He's grown into monkey see, monkey do. This guy's fair enough. He's a serial pest, but he's also been held in jail for, must be getting into the teens now, it must be 13, 14 years that I know he's been in jail for. And every time a charge comes up to court, things get dropped and then he's looking like he's going to get released, and then they just bring up another charge and they keep him in prison. And they've just, They don't want him released, which is fair enough. He shouldn't be in public, in society, as a normal civilian, because he's definitely got problems. He should probably be in a mental institution, to tell you the truth, rather than in prison.
Every time that he goes to get out, and the last time he went to get out, I read that actually the prison guards had searched his cell and found pornographic material and names and addresses of young children.
Yeah. But how do you access pornographic, especially if it's child porn? How do you access that while you're in prison?
And you believe this is part of a pedophilia ring that has been around in Adelaide for some time, is that right?
Oh, decades and decades, mate.
Mark Trevor Marshall claims to know what happened to Joanne and Kirsty. How did you find out about the claim? You mentioned that you got information or a letter that Mark had written in jail.
Yeah, I got a statement that he'd made for the Mulligan Inquiry, and I've actually got a copy of the Mulligan Inquiry and everything. And this statement was handed to the Mulligan Inquiry via Mark. And because he wasn't a state ward, they didn't investigate it.
The Mulligan Inquiry was an inquiry held in 2006 and 2007 and was investigating the abuse of children in state care. The inquiry, which included 1,592 allegations of sexual abuse and the investigation of deaths of over 924 children in state care. Mark Marshall appeared in front of Commissioner Mulligan to detail what happened to him. As part of that, there were questions around his confession letter that Bear had seen from his mate, the cafe.
Oh, yeah, I read them from three or four different points of view, like as a critic, as a skeptic, as somebody that may try to put myself in his shoes, sort of thing, to think of what he was talking about and everything. And a lot of it does sound like rambling, but a lot of it makes sense. We pulled the statement apart, me and a couple of friends of mine. We sat there and we pulled the statement apart and took out all the names and everything, and there's 19 missing children involved in that statement.
And all of those children are named in that statement?
They are named in that statement.
And so he would have to know intrinsic details of their disappearances, because as we get into your story, he gave you some information, or was certainly written in that statement, that you then went and followed up on and were able to, I guess, prove some of the stuff that he had written, in particular about Joanne and Kirsty in his statement. What was the most shocking thing that you read in his statement, Bear?
Oh, the most shocking thing would probably be just the general everyday treatment of this child when he was a child. Now, he was a child at the point of all of this taking place. You know what I mean? He was a very young child. And so you can understand some of the ramblings, like you'd be getting memory flashbacks and this back, this, that, and the next thing. And this is what I presume would have happened with him. And he was molested on a daily basis, along with numerous other children.
The opening of the transcript between Mark Marshall and the commissioner is quite telling, and also gives further insight into what shaped Mark Marshall as a child. The following is graphic in nature and is not intended to shock or disturb, but to give you some background on the allegations made by Mark. There is a trigger warning here around child abuse and items of a sexual nature. On March 16, 2007, Mark told the commissioner that the start of his abuse began when he was held at knife point by his dad from the daytime until the evening, because he'd told his teachers at school about some stuff that was happening at home. They were trying to ask him questions, but his dad wouldn't let Mark answer them. The commissioner then goes on to ask Mark if his dad did things to him, and Mark answered with a yes. He then stated it started a long time ago from when he was a baby until he went to jail for the first time, which he thought was about 18 or 19. He then also claims about what his dad did to him and his brothers and other children. Without trying to make Mark Marshall a victim in this, he certainly was a victim of some terrible abuse at a very young age.
Yeah, he definitely was, without a doubt.
And it wasn't just Mark's dad that was doing this sort of stuff to him. It was also his granddad, or Popper, as he calls him. And Popper is actually Mark's dad's father, is that right? Stanley Hart.
Yes.
That's Popper, as Mark would
call him. Who was a known pedophile.
Mark's statement says that this pedophilia that has happened to him as a young child is almost passed down through generations.
Yeah. If this is part of your life every single day, well, you're going to think it's normal, aren't you?
There is one thing that he wrote in the statement, which I will read because we're going to refer to it later in the podcast. And I think you need to know what it means so that you understand, because he refers to this particular term a lot throughout his statement in the ramblings that I've seen, and also then the statement he made to the commissioner in 2007. He said that there was a practice that he refers to as tunnelling. The commissioner at the time asked what tunnelling was, because he didn't understand. And it was a process of using an implement, normally a knitting needle, to penetrate the children. And then after that, they would then use a beer bottle to do the same to the boys and to other people that had been at the house. There was also a room in that house that that Mark talks a fair bit about. Can you tell me about that room that he refers to? I think it was called the sexy room.
Yeah, I don't know which room would have actually been the sexy room. It was probably the room that he calls Ricky's room, which is out the back. The house was just it was just an absolute mess. And there was mattresses everywhere. There was 11 single bed mattresses in one room, and all stacked on top of each other. And he describes the place quite well in his little mud map that he drew up. We actually initially searched we went and bought maps and that, and started searching for the town. We couldn't find the town on a map. And then I went on to Google and actually found the town. And as we moved down the street on the Google app, I saw the pine trees that he'd drawn on the map. And all the hair stood up on my neck. And I thought, oh, my God, this place does exist. And that was the most horrifying thing of all. Like, after I'd read the statement, I found out that the place actually existed. Me and a group of friends, we took three carloads of us because we were a little bit paranoid. So we took three carloads of us up there and went and filmed the place and went and checked it all out. It was pretty horrifying. But we walked in and we found various bits of evidence and stuff laying around. Like, we found a hat that fits the description of the hat the guy was wearing when he took the kids. There was a doctor's book in a cupboard in the lounge room, and it was a prescription properties guide. So, and it kind of tells you how to use prescription drugs properly and what they're used for and rah rah rah. And when we opened it, the book opened to a page that, you know how a book's been opened frequently to a certain page? Well, it just opened to a page where it tells you how to use particular drugs to put somebody in a hypnotic trance. The hat was in a back room, and I'd say that was the sexing room, I'd say.
Bear, you're a pretty hard man. I'm imagining, without going into detail, as part of a motorcycle gang, you would have seen some pretty heavy shit.
Yeah, kind of.
Yeah. did this shock
punch ons and stuff.
Yeah. And I'm guessing it was through the 80s and 90s, right? So, you know, back in the days where there were no laws against you hanging out with each other. So, you know, that was the norm. How did what you saw in that house compare to what you've seen in your previous life?
I was shocked. And everybody, because I had to share what I was doing with my club, because we weren't allowed to speak to police and stuff like that. So I had to get permission from my club to do it. I was pretty horrified, and so were most of the fellas. And because it was to do with children, they gave me permission to go on with it.
Have you been to jail before?
Yeah, I've been to jail.
What happens to a prisoner that is in jail that's committed some of the acts that Mark Marshall has done, and his dad and his pop?
They're usually protected. They're usually put in protective custody. And but if they're in the general population, even in protective custody, they get beatings and jugs of boiling water thrown on them and all sorts of stuff. But fair enough, I believe. Yeah. There probably should be a death penalty for people like that.
The detail in the confession that Mark Marshall wrote and was passed on to Bear and then to Susie is rambling at best. It's long and difficult to read, not just because of the graphic nature, but it sometimes goes off in tangents and is hard to follow. It's handwritten and badly spelt, but there is a meticulousness to this statement. Each page has an index with reference points, so you can sort of follow along. He's highlighted some of the worst things you can imagine happening to a child, and worse still, by a child's parents and grandparents. His letter was actually given to me by Susie Ratcliffe, and when we talked about it, Susie said it took a good 6 months for her to read. For Susie, it wasn't about the disjointedness. It was that this document contained lots of references to her sister Joanne and some of the vile things that Mark Marshall alleges were done to her.
His statement, which I have a copy of, it's quite mind-boggling, and it's very confronting with the details that he goes, does explain. He goes into quite a lot of detail about how the girls were kidnapped, what his grandfather did to them, over the ensuing days, and then how they ended up in the barrels, which were ultimately dumped at the Pekina Dam. And with all of these details that he's given to in this statement, Bear and his crew have investigated. They located the barrels pretty much exactly where Mark Trevor Marshall said they were going to be. They also located other pieces of evidence that Mark Trevor Marshall has given in his statement out at Stanley Hart's home.
What was...
Which is in Yatna, South Australia.
What was Mark Trevor Marshall's reasons for doing this statement? Do you know?
I don't think it was out of guilt. I think maybe it's more of an attention-seeking thing. You've got to understand he's a very twisted, sick individual from what I've read, what I've heard. I've also had contact from his ex-girlfriend, and she's told me a number of things about him. He's a very troubled person.
In the next episode of Little Girls Lost...
When we opened the barrels, they stunk, and all the remaining liquid had poured out of them, and then we took the solids and got them tested. Well, Hart was a known pedophile in Adelaide, and he was put on that property by government. He was sent out to there to get him away from Adelaide because he was molesting too many children. if you've got a pedophile ring that's catering for the high end of society, you probably want to protect that pedophile ring. Yeah.
Mark Marshall, you believe you know his real identity?
Well, there's a very strong possibility because he fits the same age group. He's around the same age, and I believe that he may possibly be Grant Beaumont.
It was such a shock, and I couldn't grasp it. I thought, oh, you know, someone's playing some, you know, stupid joke. This is ridiculous. And it just, at that point, I just thought, you know, I'm it. It just, it floored me to think that, you know, we've fought so hard for so long, and everything that I've been fighting for is, it hasn't been worth it.
There are over 38,000 long-term missing person cases in Australia, and the story you've just heard is one of them. We want to continue to help bring these emotional stories of ambiguous loss to you so we can spread the word and hopefully get some closure for the families. For as little as the price of a coffee a month, you can help support us to keep creating this content. Just head to our Patreon page. The link is in the show notes.